All right, everyone should be on. Thank you for taking the time. I know we usually have been doing these at noon, but I pushed it back to 1 o'clock. So hopefully that's okay with everyone. And the good news is we've been doing these quarterly, which is a heck of a lot better than last year when we were doing them at one point every 2 weeks. So if you're looking for a pretty simple algorithm, the less webinars we're doing, the better the market is. So you should use that as your guidepost for how markets are, is how often you're hearing from me through a webinar. Before I get started on where we are in markets and what happened in the first half of the year and what our outlook is going forward, I do want to just give you a quick update on where Bernstein is on return to the office. We have started to slowly bring staff back in starting this month. Our goal is to slowly pick those numbers up, and then September, October, so I'm thinking roughly post Labor Day, be back to some semblance of normal. I don't think anyone in any industry in any city knows exactly what that normal will look like. I know people will probably ask, are you going to be in the office 5 days a week or four or three? And I think the reality is that I think most industries are going to be in some sort of hybrid format. But I think once we get through the summer, assuming things are okay with the Delta variant, we'll be back doing meetings, and your experience with Amanda, myself, and Bernstein will be back to whatever that the new normal will look like. So with that as a backdrop, let me take you through, from a market perspective, what's gone on year to date, the first half of the year. And you'll see that in contrast to the right-hand side of the screen, which is the full year 2020, the year of the pandemic. And so it's a really good story year to date in the equity markets, whether you're in the US, you're in developed international markets, emerging markets, US growth and value, really anything you've bought in the stock market here or abroad has gone up. There are going to be distinctions. We're going to focus more on the gap between growth and value in the coming minutes, but you'll note a reasonable reversal because full year 2020, growth was up, as you see here, 38%. Well, value stocks were only up 3%. This year, value is ahead of growth, which feels like the first time in nearly a decade. Credit is bonds. And so if you look at corporate bonds, both globally and the US, they were slightly negative to start the year. The high yield market, so other bonds that are more risky, more economically sensitive, they feel a little bit like stock, although they're actually bonds. Those were positive to start the year. Government bonds, US treasuries were down. Municipal bonds were essentially flat. And real assets, commodities, real estate, things that are hard goods that tend to be sensitive to inflation, and that's going to be a big part of today's discussion, did really well to start the year. So by any broad stretch, whether you're a conservative client with 20-30% stock at Bernstein, or an aggressive client with 80-100% stock at Bernstein, I think you're going to be really happy in absolute terms with what your performance is like, because equity markets are up so much and bond markets are essentially flat, even though we've been in a difficult interest rate environment. So I'm going to frame this discussion today, which I think will run about a half hour if you're trying to keep time on your clocks, around a handful of questions. And I think the first one that we get, which is broad, is now that the economy's reopened and markets are around on the Dow $35,000, what's left to push the stock market higher? And we think the global economy is still recovering. We think the conditions for more stock market appreciation are actually pretty good. A lot of that's based on monetary policy and what's going on in the central banks. I'll talk more about that. And maybe even most simply, where else are you going to go with your investments today? If you think in the most broadest terms, right? The government printed enormous amounts of money through the coronavirus crisis. And that took its shape and form a number of different ways, whether it was small business loans, direct injection of money into capital markets and the bond market. There is tons of money floating around, both in banks, in corporate America, and actually on US investors' balance sheets. And so if you're trying to make some money on that money, and the interest rate environment at the bank or in the bond market is next to nothing, but you want to generate return, where else are you going to go other than riskier assets like stocks? And if you'd want even more return than stock, that's part of the reason why riskier parts of the market, whether that's Bitcoin — I'm not saying Bitcoin is real or not, I'm just arguing it's riskier than owning GE stock, or NFTs, which are a form of crypto, or private equity — anything that takes on more risk. Think about what's gone on with the GameStop stocks and the AMCs of the world. Anywhere there's more risk for the potential for more return, when there's too much money floating around there, it will go chase those returns. And that's part of what you've seen today. More on that in a minute. So where are we today? This chart thinks about the world versus a year ago from a fiscal policy perspective, which is the Fed, a monetary policy perspective, fiscal policy being the government, monetary policy being the Fed, economic activity and inflation. Now, almost all scorecards, things look better today than they did a year ago, except on inflation. I'm going to table that for a second. I used to show a chart in all of these webinars where I divided the world into, I think, three simple segments. I've been talked out of using it anymore, but I think it's a good way to frame things for a discussion. I think the world today is still based on three big concepts. What's going on with the coronavirus? What's monetary policy? And how's the economy doing? And I think where we are today, from both a coronavirus perspective, an economy perspective, and a financial conditions perspective, monetary policy, et cetera perspective, has some question marks. And those question marks, I think, are the debate in the market, and is why you get days and weeks where markets are down, not sharply, but they're down, and then a week or a month where markets rally sharply. And so what are those question marks, right? I think we all agree we're in a much better place from the coronavirus than we were 6 or 12 or 18 months ago. That said, there are some questions about what's going to happen with this Delta variant. And if you put that as a question on your scorecard, I think until we have certainty as to whether Delta is a really big problem or it's not a problem, that's going to dictate where markets go. Because if the Delta variant is rampant and to any degree the economy has to shut down to any degree, or economic activity slows down or people spend less, that's going to pull back the market. If Delta virus is nothing, and I'm not going to pretend here to be a doctor and be able to answer that, markets will go forward. So the market wants news on Delta. On fiscal policy, look, it is clearly accommodative. Jay Powell and the Fed are clearly playing ball. But the question is, for how much longer? And so everybody on Wall Street and in the press is trying to get hints as to what fiscal policy will be, both in this country and abroad, over the next 6, 12, 18 months. If the Fed slams the brakes, markets are going to go down. Nobody expects they will, but that's the question, right? And what's the risk of it overheating if they keep slamming on the gas? Our view is, and most people's view is, that the Fed will slowly pump the brakes on supporting the economy as things get better. But if there's any veer off course there, markets are going to react. By the way, every time you see a hint that they're going to veer one way or the other, markets have that sharp week, month, et cetera. And lastly, the economy looks really good, right? I think the only way the economy turns here is if the first two things don't work out from a Delta variant perspective and a fiscal policy perspective. If those two things work in our favor, look, the economy is really good today. We could debate how good and, you know, what basic numbers we're coming off of, but those numbers are really strong. So where do we stand today? We think a more certain leg of the recovery versus where we were a year ago. GDP forecast, so a measure of economic condition in the U.S., our forecast is 6.5% this year. Not too long ago, we were in the 4 range. Global GDP also above 6. 10-year treasuries, we're lower than this today. We're about 1.4, but we think we'll end the year in the 1.75 to 2 range. Inflation is higher at 3%, but it's not 5 or 6. I mean, it will show those quarter over quarter, year over year, because we're coming off comparisons of 2020. Where the number was so low. So, you know, if you have a low base, it's easy to put up a really big one quarter number. But for the year, we think it'll be more like in the 3s. And S&P 500 earnings per share. So how well are companies growing their businesses? Last year, obviously, in the coronavirus pandemic, they contracted. This year, earnings growth at 37% is really strong. All that said, if you look a little bit longer term, so I'm now looking out 10 years, what is our forecast for return in various different asset allocation strategies. From a market perspective, our job at Bernstein is to pick the right stocks and the right bonds, and net of fees do much better than these. But what's our baseline forecast for portfolios over the next 10 years? And you'll see on the left, 100% bond portfolio. We think municipal bonds baseline in the market returns just south of 1%. That's a historically very low number. That dotted yellow line is what it was over the last 10 years, which was in the low twos. But the probability of losing 20% is virtually nothing. As you get to the more moderate portfolio, 60-40, an expected return is south of 4%, 3.7, where traditionally that number was north of 6, right? And there's a 29% chance, a 1 in 3, that at some point, that portfolio, 60 stock, 40 bonds, falls by 20%. So risk is higher, return is lower over the next 10 years. If you go all the way out to 100% stock portfolio, our projection is that 100% stock portfolio returns 5.3%. Now, it could do much better than that. I can make the case for why it would, but our base case conservative view is 5.3% before our ability to pick the right stocks on top of that over the next 10 years for stock. And a very high likelihood that if you own an all stock portfolio over the next 10 years, at some point, it would fall by 20%. So we're in a period where we're telling clients, expect your return over the next decade to be more muted and expect to have to live through some tough times. And why is that? Well, the market's already high in the US. And for bonds, you've got low current interest rates. You know, interest rates are your friend if you're a bond investor. If you can go out there and get 4.5% on a bond tax-free, it's a pretty good deal. That's not the numbers you get today. So until we can get to a point of higher rates, bond returns are going to be much lower. So let's talk about inflation. It's probably the thing most people have been talking about day in, day out. You'll see a lot of really ugly headline numbers, but we think that pressure is going to fade. Yet for many, and we've said this for years, there should be a layer of inflation protection in your portfolio if you fit into a subset of our clients. Let me just tell you why inflation has gone up and why we think it's not going to be long-lived to the degree you've seen. The supply chain is, if not broken, under a lot of strain, in part because the labor force has been tough to get fully back, and in part because things as simple as shipping out of China has been very difficult. So if you're trying to get goods into this country and you can't get them on a ship in Asia to get them over to this country, it's a backlog. Or if you have to spend an exorbitant amount on containers to get it over to America, it pushes the price higher. So we've got supply chain issues that we think will work themselves out over time as our workforce comes back and the backlog in shipping starts to work its way through. The inflation numbers you've seen, and this is on the right of late, have really been focused on goods, which goes back to the supply chain issue, shelter, housing, et cetera. That's where the inflationary pressure is. We don't think that is going to be long-term. I don't think you're going to get a real good feel for inflation for at least the fourth quarter of this year at the earliest, because we've got to get past 12-month comparisons from a year ago during the pandemic to have any feel for kind of like what's real. Everything looks like it's inflationary when you compare it to an economy that was literally shut down in 2020. Let me give you, I think this is like a really fascinating chart. This is timber. This is a chart of timber year to date. You say, well, it's a pretty crazy chart, but you know, maybe not wild as could be. Timber started the year pricing at about 700-800. It got to as high as 1700. Okay, so you had timber basically double to triple in price. If you've been to Home Depot, if you're dealing with contractors, you know how much the price of wood has gone up, 2x4s, et cetera. That's all on this chart. That said, it completely collapsed in June. Timber was down 40% in June. It was the largest decline ever over a month. And so when you have an asset class in May, you'd sit there and say, oh my God, there's a ton of inflation. If you just look from here to here, you'd say, oh my God, there's a ton of deflation. Which one is it? By the way, if I change this from a year-to-date chart and I show you over 5 years, doesn't that chart look really pretty bland from 2017 until you get to the crisis? So you're looking at, you know, periods of abnormalities that can make your data look really weird, right? Because those Mount Everest on this chart, we know were driven by coronavirus, right? And pandemic and post-pandemic world. The question is, as we normalize, what's the real inflationary number as we get back down? And this is the type of stuff we think normalizes over time that we're not living with way out. That all said, we do think inflation sensitivity should be in your portfolio, depending on your own circumstances. And we're using three sliding bars here. One is, how much are you allocated to bonds? How much are you spending from your portfolio? And or how long until you retire? So there's all this, and in our individual conversations, we'll go through the stuff on the right here. But this is to say, the more you have bonds in the portfolio, the more sensitive you are to inflation. Now, it's often true that people who have more bonds in their portfolio are retirees. Doesn't have to be true, but often true. Retirees are more sensitive to inflation, not just because they own more bonds, but because their wages are no longer part of the economic condition, right? They're not in the labor force. During periods of spikes in inflation, you anticipate wages to go up. So if you're working, yes, inflation impacts you, but you should see the quote unquote benefit of inflation or the catch up in inflation in your income, in your pay. If you're not working, you don't have your pay stub to offset the inflationary impact, right? The cost of bread is going up, but your wages aren't going up with it. And so your portfolio really has to fight inflation. And if you're allocated heavily to bonds, it tells you you need more and more inflation protection in the portfolio. Generally speaking, we do that through commodities and real assets, but we also do it in the bond market. And to tell you more about how we do it in the bond market, I thought it would be great to show a video from our senior bond portfolio manager, Daryl Clements. Many of you have seen him speak and have met him one-on-one. He's been with us forever. Let me give you his thoughts on inflation and bonds.
Municipal bond investors are clearly worried about rising rates and rising inflation. How do I protect myself, I being the investor, how do I protect myself against rising rates and rising inflation? Because the idea is to win without losing in this environment. Now, one way to do that is to buy a TIP, a Treasury Inflation Protected Security, and that will clearly protect you against inflation. But is it the most tax efficient way to provide that inflation protection? Because a TIP, the treasury component of it, the income off that is taxed at ordinary income tax rates. The inflation component is also taxed at ordinary income tax rates, but here's the kicker there. You don't receive the benefit of it the year that it's realized. You receive it when the bond matures, yet you're paying the income tax during the year it's realized, something known as phantom income. So what do you do about it? Well, a better option for someone paying taxes is to have a combination of municipal bonds and CPI swaps. And what's a CPI swap? A consumer price index swap? Very simple. A swap, all a swap is a exchange of payments. So if I enter into a 5-year CPI swap with a counterparty, I'm going to pay them whatever the fixed rate is at the time we enter into that swap. And over the next 5 years, say it's a 5-year swap, they'll pay me what actual inflation is. So as yields are rising and inflation expectations are likely rising because there's a high correlation between the two, even though the bonds may be losing value, the swaps are gaining in value. And that's where you get your offset. And the tax efficiency comes in the form of, well, the municipal bonds are tax exempt and the swaps are taxed at capital gain rates, not ordinary income tax rates. So that's where you get the tax efficiency from. Now, what I would urge investors not to do is invest in cash, because cash will lose over time. Yes, it feels safe. It's synonymous with safety. And in the initial bouts of rising rates, it may outperform an intermediate bond, but over subsequent 6-12 months, a bond portfolio will tend to outperform over time.
So So Daryl hit on a few important notes there that I'm going to expand on. One is the notion of investing in cash versus bonds. And two, I'm going to wrap up this discussion with a talk about taxes, because I know he talked about tax in the form of inflation protection, but I'm pretty sure everyone on this call has a lot of questions and thoughts about potential tax changes via the Biden administration. So I will talk about that as well. Just to be fair with everyone, we're about 20 minutes in. I'm probably just over halfway through, so we might run about 40 minutes. Daryl talked about return in the municipal market. I think it's important that we give you our forecast for from here, what our expectations are on an intermediate municipal bond portfolio, given different treasury environments. Now, this excludes what we think we can do with credit research and repositioning portfolios and taking advantage of mispricings in the market. But if you just set a 12-month return on a high credit quality, intermediate duration municipal bond portfolio, which is kind of our flagship for clients, if the 10-year treasury stays around 147, you know, it's a little lower than that today, we think you'll make about 1% on your bonds before we can do better than that. If the 10-year treasury pops up to 175, it's about 30 basis points before we add an active management premium on that. If the 10-year treasury falls to 125, you're closer to 1.7 before we add a premium there as well. Remember, those are all tax-free numbers. So you're between 0.3 in an odd case, and we think we'll do better, and 1.7% tax-free. If you go to the bank, you're probably not going to get these returns, and the return you get on a CD or money market, half of that roughly is going to the government. So on a tax equivalent basis, you could almost double these numbers. Just for instance, in your IRAs, in our taxable bond portfolios, or if you're a foundation on this call or an institutional client, 10-year treasury stays the same, we think the return is 2.4. 10-year treasury goes up, we think it's 0.9. 10-year treasury goes down, we think it's about 3.6. These numbers are higher because they're not tax-free, right? But we use these portfolios in things like an IRA or in other non-taxable entities because there is no 50% tax bite. That's just a feel for where we think we're going in bond markets over the short term, next 12 months. Now, another conversation I've had with a number of clients is, okay, I'm in the U.S., not everyone on this call is, but I have a big allocation to the U.S. portfolio. When are the non-U.S. parts of my stock portfolio going to start to perform, and why would they? And simple answer on the right, continued economic acceleration, vaccine catch-up overseas, and this gap in valuation. So let's at least frame where we are since last summer. The performance of non-US markets versus US is basically flat. I think that will surprise most people because I think they still think the US is way ahead of foreign markets. It's very close over the last 12 months. Over the last 5 or 10 years, it's not close. And that's going to speak to what the difference in valuation is going forward. Okay. As we get greater confidence in the outcome with coronavirus and the global recovery, it'll reward countries that are more economically sensitive. And there are a number of countries outside the US that have lots of commodities that are very economically sensitive that will do better as the economy grows. And it will do better as their vaccination programs ramp up. So on the left, I'm showing the United States in the blue vaccination rollout, okay? And then in the darker blue is Germany, Spain, France, Italy, and the assorted colors. You see they're all sort of on their same path. And you can see how much faster the US vaccination rollout was versus Europe. They're about 2.5 months behind us, okay? And so it wouldn't be surprising if their GDP recovery is behind us as well. And you can see that when we look at the blue US changes in GDP on the right versus the Eurozone, also on the right chart, but on the right in the purplish. The cumulative change in GDP since the fourth quarter of 2019, so like, is their economy growing or is it not? The US economy is slightly slower than it was, or smaller than it was December of 2019. The Eurozone economy is meaningfully smaller than it was winter of 2019. So there's more, if you think of the notion of like a coil, there's more spring left in the Eurozone coil to get back to normal than there is in the US. And because of that, and this goes back, you know, a decade plus, international stocks, non-US stocks broadly, are cheap in comparison to the S&P 500. Throughout this chart, the blue line, the US market, the S&P, is in almost all instances more expensive than the green line, which is foreign markets. But you'll see throughout here, it's not wildly different. There's not a lot of white, right? There's not a lot of air between those blue and green lines. But as you move forward, and this is the long story, it's not just about the pandemic, really kind of post-financial crisis, the blue and the green have really gapped out. And I know I'm really zooming in here, but if you look at the air between the blue and the green in 2021 versus 2007 and 6 and 5 and what had been always historically true, we look at that and say, wow, I'm getting a lot more earnings for my money overseas than I am in the US. And I should get rewarded for buying that good, that company cheap over the next 5 or 10 years. The problem is, right, you know, there's no perfect precision here. When you see that gap on the chart, you'd say, well, I should buy all the international I can. That doesn't mean that gap squeezes back right away. It can take time. So most of our clients are between, depends on their individual circumstances, 20 to 40% foreign markets. I have had clients say, well, why not go to 50? If you think this is such a big number, it's so compelling, go further. Well, again, I don't have the perfect precision of the crystal ball of telling you the timing. And secondly, when we go overseas, we pick up currency risk, right? And so how much currency fluctuation do we want to add to your portfolio just to buy stocks overseas? So we've got to weigh that cost analysis benefit. Okay. All right. Let me take you forward to where we are now on our next scorecard. Okay. So next question we got is, and this goes in waves, tell me about GameStop, AMC, Hertz has been one of those. Like, really, how is this going on? If you remember the old Seth Meyers skit, really, this is the Wall Street version of really. So do fundamentals, does research matter anymore at all? And our view is yes, definitely right now, especially related to advice, diversification, research, and if nothing else, discipline. Because if you can't come up with a good research conclusion on GameStop, AMC, and you can't come up with a fundamental story for why it's happening, good or bad, in our view, if you don't have a fundamental rationale for what's happening in the market, don't put your money behind it, long or short, meaning don't buy the hype, don't sell against the hype, just take your money and put it somewhere else where you have a more grounded understanding of what's happening at a company or in a bond and can go to bed at night understanding that business, their suppliers, their capital structure. Where in the GameStop and AMC stories, you just look at charts going, this doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't. And if that's your conclusion, we would say, move on. Anchor yourself to fundamental research. And so that advice matters. People have been on this call, have seen this chart a million times. It's about what we were saying through the crisis and where we are today. I don't want to belabor it. I would just say that March 31st, in our last webinar, one of the things we published was economic boom, economic backdrop improves further, but it would be a slow grind higher. That has been true. If you've been caught sitting on cash for this whole period of time, you've lost return that I don't know that you'll ever see again in the next 10 or 20 years. And it leads to the question of, and Daryl talked about cash, right? You could argue cash versus bonds, but a lot of our clients think, okay, it's not about bonds. It's about, do I buy the stock market with my cash at this price? And here's my answer, better to be in the game than not. Because if you're going to be in the game, in the market for the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 30 plus years for a number of our clients, it's about being in and compounding and the time value of money over many years. It's not about when you got in. It's about when you got in for the first week, for the first month, even the first year, and in an extreme, the first 2, 3, or 4 years, right? If you put all of your money into the market right before the coronavirus crisis, that would have been terrible timing, but today you're a heck of a lot wealthier than you were then. Even with the worst timing you could find, same thing would have been true in 2008. It just would have taken 2 or 3 years. So if you've got more than that period of time, our argument would be get off the sidelines. And this chart nails that, because even investing at the top of the market has been better than being on the sidelines. And this is since World War II. The average return of the market since World War II is 11.3 on the bottom. If you kept buying the market at the wrong time, just terrible luck. You just kept saying, you know what, it's gone up. I don't know what to do. Fine, I'll just put it in. And you timed it terribly. Your return was 10.4. I agree. 11.3 is better than 10.4. And if you bought the market bottoms, it's a lot better than 11.3. But 10.4 is life-changingly better than the average return of 4% on cash. Now, I don't think the 10.4 is real today, right? I think that's, as you saw on earlier charts, 5, 6%. But the cash number is zero. So the gap is still 6%. In my view, the vast majority of investors and clients cannot afford to give up 6% return indefinitely. So balance remains the sage advice. And I've talked about a number of these phenomenon before. You've seen this slide before, and we talked about international and US already, but it's these pockets of dislocation, small cap, large cap, growth and value, international and foreign markets, where we think we can squeeze out a little bit of extra return in stock markets over the next few years. And why does fundamental research matter? You heard me talk through the COVID crisis and throughout 2020 and even the start of this year about FANG stocks, right? Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, all of them, about how the market was really just focused on that handful of stock and the rest of the market wasn't going up. Well, if you start the clock at a different point in time, August 31st of last year, and say what's happened since then, and it really starts to gap out post-election and the notion that the vaccine was coming out, the S&P 500 on the right, excluding FANG, is up 37%. The FANGs are up 21%. Now, I would say there is nothing wrong with being up 21%. But that is massive underperformance versus the market ex the FANGs up 37%. Right? So there has been a rotation here. And to the extent that interest rates are going to go up over the next few years, that will hurt the FANG stocks more than it will the rest of the market. And the left is really the same chart as the right. I'm just showing it differently. But you can see in terms of gap between that green and blue line, it's a lot over time. All right. The tax question. I have no idea. Every week, every day, we focus on this. We have research meetings on this, and it's honestly unclear. I can tell you what's been proposed. I can tell you what some of the impacts would be, but what's going to get actually passed in BC? It's like, I don't know who's going to win the World Series this year. It's a really hard thing to guess on, and I think forecasting DC is even harder. I worked in DC earlier in my career. It's really hard, and so much of it is unclear. And how it will impact the people on this call is going to be very specific on your individual circumstances, and how those negotiations go could definitely impact people differently on this call. For instance, just give you two examples. Are they, quote unquote, going after people with $1 million of income, or is it $400,000? That could impact you differently if you're in one bucket versus the other. What is considered income? Is income just like W-2 wages, or is it municipal bond income and everything that happens in your portfolio and capital gains? That could make you actually hit the $400,000 number, or it can make you hit the $1 million number where you'd otherwise say, I don't make that. So the notion of, is it AGI or modified AGI? Like, there are all lots of little data points in this that are going to make this really complicated. Let me give you the high level of what's on the table that I think you should think about. Things that are being talked about are just a general increasing of tax rates. There's a step up in basis related to people's estates when they pass. That may change or go away. How do capital gains look? And we're writing on the right, lots of different Q&As, and there's blogs and research. So if this is an area that you really want to dig your teeth into, myself, Amanda, my colleagues, we're happy to do that. And we've got tons of resources that we're putting out there for you. Even things like the, if you're in California or New York or any of the high state tax states, it was thought of as the SALT deductions. It got political with a blue state tax. You lost your state tax deduction in the Trump tax reform. There's questions as to whether or not you could get it back, right? So this could get all convoluted. And when these changes would be enacted, as of the start of next year, retroactive to last year, all gets complicated. There are a number of different executive branch tax proposals. I'm just listing them here. I'm not going to quiz you on this later, but I'm really just putting it up here so you know that myself and Bernstein and my team are really in the weeds of all that's happening from the executive branch side and the legislative branch. And, you know, we've gone through the American Families Plan, et cetera, but high level things to think about. I mean, I don't know that most of you want to have me on this call go through what happens with carried interest. Here's the headlines, I think, for most. Capital gains rates. Long-term capital gains rates right now are 23.8%. The Biden proposal would move it up to your ordinary income tax rates, effectively. And it says taxpayers with income over $1 million. Again, what that's, where those thresholds are going to be and what's going to be considered are very important, not insignificant details, but in broad strokes, long-term capital gains would go from 23.8 to 43%. That is a material increase and would materially change how we trade your portfolios. Right now, short-term capital gains for high taxpayers is at 43. But if you hold the stock over a year, the tax falls from 43 to 23. That may go away. That would impact how we advise you, how we trade your portfolios, et cetera, et cetera. Again, we can have a whole deeper discussion on this. Also, I did a podcast. You can get it. You can ask Amanda or myself where to get it with our director of research, Tara Thompson Popernick, all on tax. So if you want the deep dive on tax with Tara and myself, she's terrific. Just let us know and we'll get you hooked up with that podcast. I would also say if you're a business owner on this call, the tax increase on capital gains actually gives an incentive for people who are business owners thinking about selling their business to sell much sooner than they otherwise would have. Because what we looked at is how much additional enterprise value do you have to create in your business? So like how much more do you have to grow your business to offset the tax? If you only hold the business one more year, you got to grow your business by 145% to make the tax hit worth it. Over 10 years, you got to grow your business by 10% a year. That's achievable for some businesses, isn't for others. How you think about that, your age may impact what you do about your business looking at the tax gun. Also on a corporate level, current laws, tax rates are 21% on corporate. The proposal would move that up to 28. Okay. There's some discussion that 25 may be where that settles. Again, we don't have answers, but I want you to know that we're thinking about it. And here are the big, broad take homes. There's also the Ford the 99.5 Act bill, which Senator Sanders has pushed. This talks a lot about the estate tax and gift tax and GST exemptions. If you're exposed to the estate tax, this would impact you. If you weren't, this may affect you. Current law is each person has an estate tax exemption of $11.7 million. So if you're an individual and you have a less than $11.7 million in total assets, you're not going to be impacted by the estate tax. If you're married, double that, north of $23 million. Biden's proposal takes it down to 3.5. So if you think about the world in terms of like big circles and you say everyone within the, as a married couple, if you got over $23 million, you're in the estate tax circle. That circle's not that big. If you take that circle and say, okay, it's no longer a $23 million circle, it's a $7 million circle. So everyone between $7 and $23 million get in. That's likely to impact lots of our clients, especially when you think about real estate assets. And so this could be a big deal. And we're thinking about that. And there's all the things on the right to talk about as well. I just want to end with a few things that you should be aware of through communications with us. The new website's been launched. The app has been updated. To the extent that you're depositing into your Bernstein account, you can now use the Bernstein app to do a mobile check deposit. So you don't have to wire us funds or write us checks. This has become much easier. That's an update we've done in the last few weeks. And we're trying to be really on top of staying in front of you with insights and white papers and blogs and podcasts. So if there is a topic that is of particular interest to you, let Amanda or myself know. We may have something on it, or we're willing to do the research to learn about it. If there's a podcast topic you think would be of interest or you want to speak about, I'm happy to do that. Later this month, we're going to release a podcast on a research piece we just did on medical practices, dental practices, what's gone on in that industry with hospital consolidation, private equity is involved. So we're going to do a whole podcast, should be released in the next week or two on that topic. And then we'll go down other paths as we get through the summer. So I said I would run 30 minutes. I revised and said I'd be closer to 40. I'm at 41. So I appreciate all of you taking your time. Any follow-up questions, as always, feel free to reach out directly to my team, Amanda, or myself. Most important, stay safe, try and recharge this summer, and I hopefully don't need to do another one of these till the end of the third quarter, because that means markets are behaving. But know that if they're not, or something radical happens, not only will you hear from us directly, but we'll do another one of these webinars as soon as necessary. Thank you for your time. Stay safe. Enjoy the summer.